It's a great pleasure for me to be the moderator on this panel of professionals who have agreed to respond to, this is session number 27, the question, Mormon Arts, What, Whence, and Whither? As I talked to some of my colleagues at Brigham Young about what we were doing up here, the typical response was, hasn't enough been said about already about Mormon Arts, and aren't we flogging a dead horse? I suppose we will all answer part of that question at the end of the session today. In the meantime, let me begin by defining some parameters for our discussion, making a stab at some basic definitions of Mormon art, and then outlining the procedures we will follow for the next hour and a half, and then introducing you to each of the participants in order. After I introduce the topic for today, each panelist will present a written out or well-outlined statement of approximately 15 minutes. In order as they are listed in your program, after which we will entertain questions and comments from you. Because of the limited time on the back end, we'll have approximately 20 minutes at the end after the four 15-minute presentations. I would encourage you to take good notes on your reactions to each panelist's ideas and then phrase your questions succinctly so that as many as possible can become involved in the discussion. One of the basic premises of this panel, and indeed of all art history books, is that the arts provide a valuable index of a culture and of its fundamental values. Just a couple of supporting quotes in this idea. Helen Gardner wrote, "It is a fundamental working hypothesis of art history that works produced at the same time will generally have common stylistic traits." The pioneer past and the contemporary present in Mormon arts represent two burgeoning times of creative activity, both within a relatively limited time frame. For this reason, we can see distinct style traits when contrasting the two, yet a common style seems to pervade all art produced by the Mormon culture. Another quote from Kenneth Clark, who actually is quoting John Ruskin in his book Civilization. He says, "Great nations write their autobiographies in three manuscripts, the book of their deeds, the book of their words, and the book of their art. Not one of these books can be understood unless we read the other two. But of the three, the only trustworthy one is the arts." Some of us would perhaps want to dispute this claim, if only because some of our church art seems so much less profound than the theology that inspired it. Anytime we raise the question of Mormon art, we simultaneously broach the subject of the relationship between art and religion. In any era but our own, that link would seem not only natural but necessary. From Homer through Matthew Arnold, the moral dimension of art was a given, not an aberration. And even more recent novelists, like Flannery O'Connor, maintain this traditional moral stance. She writes, "For the novelist, judgment is implicit in the act of seeing. His vision cannot be detached from his moral sense. The fact is that ethics and aesthetics are inseparable in art." John Tanner's literary syllogism applies, I believe, to all of the arts, where he says, "Literature cannot be separated from life, and life cannot be separated from moral concerns. Therefore, moral concerns must have a primary role in the understanding and appreciation of literature," and I would say of all art. John Gardner's book on moral fiction, written back in 1978, he argued that moral premises are remarkably akin to those of, that the ideals held up in a proper work of art ultimately come from God. And these ideas are very close to what President Kimball has written. He says, Gardner says, "Therefore, the gods set ideals, heroes enact them, and artists or artist historians preserve the image as a moral guide for man." President Kimball's essay back in 1977 posed the following somewhat rhetorical question. "In the field of both composition and performance, why cannot someone write a greater oratorio than Handel's Messiah?" Implying by the question that, one, we have not yet done so, and two, we can and ought to by virtue of the awe-inspiring material we have at our disposal. He refers to things like Christ's visit to the Nephites or Joseph's first vision and so forth. As well as the creative edge Mormon artists ought to have by virtue of the expressive influence of the Holy Ghost. President Kimball envisioned a new era of greatness in the arts and the church, citing the great films, literature, and sculpture of the past. And writing, he says, "I believe we can improve on them. It remains for inspired hearts and talented fingers yet to reveal themselves. But," and this is the qualification, "they must be faithful, inspired, active church members to give life and feeling and true perspective to a subject so worthy. This statement necessarily redefines truly Mormon art as art produced by skilled but fervent Latter-day Saints. It will be interesting for us all, I believe, to discover how our four panelists define Mormon art. The peculiarity of the Mormon people seems to come through most readily when viewed from outside their culture. How many times have non-LDS people observed that there is something different about members and missionaries? What is that difference, and how does it manifest itself not only in the varied art forms produced by creative Mormons, but in the widely divergent geographical settings as the church becomes a truly world religion? These are all still important questions for anyone interested in the nature of the arts of Mormondom and the unique role they play in religious lives of the saints. Well, my only qualification for being on this panel, or for even having organized the panel, is that I was working on a project several years ago called, tentatively called, A Documentary History of Mormon Arts, which never got off the ground because two of the committee weren't able to complete their work. Nevertheless, I had the chance to interview many different creative LDS people and learn firsthand what motivated them to sandwich their creative efforts into sometimes very exhausting time schedules. I will now introduce our first panelist, if I can find my notes here, Merrill Bradshaw. He's the John R. Halliday Professor of Music and Composer in Residence at Brigham Young University, where he has taught for the past 34 years. He has composed over 200 musical works, ranging from simple piano pieces and songs to concerti, oratorios, pageants, and symphonies. His works have been performed by the Utah Symphony, San Diego Symphony, Phoenix Symphony, Detroit Symphony, Auckland, Queensland, and Perth Symphonies, and the U.S. Air Force Orchestra, plus numerous university ensembles. I just noted, as we were talking this morning before the panel, that he's writing a piece for the dedication of the new museum in at Brigham Young University, basing his works on five paintings that are in our collection, one of which is by Gary Smith. So I think that's an interesting, a propitious connection here today. So we will turn the time over now to Dr. Bradshaw.
I was interested in John's initial comment that some people feel that the Mormon art thing had been talked to death. Actually, in the last 15 years, that kind of dialogue seems to have ceased, and I find this meeting today to be part of a dialogue that ought to continue, not just in this kind of situation, but among artists, among audiences, and so on, so that the vitality of the art is maintained. Because when that dialogue ceases, however repetitious it may become, people stop looking intensely at the art that is produced, and we lose some values that are very important. I initially began my considerations of what to say today with two or three focuses, and as I worked with them, I've had to narrow it down to one. I hope it's the right one. I want to talk about Mormon art and its definition. From a consideration of the language, I note there are really two parts of the term, the noun art and the adjective Mormon. The question, what is art, is itself an endless quest. But again, looking at the way we use the language, art encompasses at least two aspects, the way the materials of the medium are managed and the nature of the vision that's communicated. It seems likely that the two meanings are so intertwined as to be inseparable. To some extent, at least, the medium is the message. At least it carries the features of the message. Let's talk about the management of the materials. For me, a work careless of the materials of which it is made cannot be called art. Such a work may perhaps have a marketing, a propaganda, or a social purpose. But because of the flaws in its construction, the person observing or participating in the art experience finds himself distracted from the message of the art. Bad art always turns out to be bad religion. The simple inclusion of a gospel reference in an inferior work is no salvation for the work, but is almost always an aspersion on the gospel. Not only that, such flaws preempt the possibility of perceiving the deeper unity between the structure of the work and the vision that animates it. Artists who have not yet mastered the technical problems of the art seldom have time to consider relations between structure and vision as they may pertain to the work they are producing. They feel that when they have achieved a minimal solution to the basics of technique, they've accomplished what they were supposed to do. I have just recently witnessed the annual miracle of the Barlow Endowment selection process in their international competition and their commissioning of new works. The Board of Advisors examines hundreds of entries each year. Among all these works, four stages of development are visible. The first is the technical struggle. This is essentially the student who is trying to master the materials of his art. If all the notes resolve correctly, he feels he has succeeded. The second is the performance struggle. This is the kind of work in which the composer is primarily concerned with providing the accomplished performer an opportunity to show what he can do. It culminates in the virtuoso show-off piece. The third is the formal struggle. In this area, the composer is primarily concerned with formal balance and interest, and at this level, a well-balanced piece is the culmination. The fourth level, and the best and also the most difficult one, is the artistic dilemma. Having mastered the language, one must ask himself or herself, what do I really want to say? In my own case, after working within the 12-tone system, for example, for several years, I became aware that I had mastered the technique to the point I could make it do whatever I wanted. At that point, the ultimate artistic dilemma presented itself. What do I want, really? It is when the artist wrestles with this kind of question that we find the unity of mastery of the medium and the substance of the vision that can produce a work that is artistic in the true sense of the word. It is my observation in our competitions that the judges are interested mostly in the works that do this. Those that are still preoccupied with the first three struggles seem to awaken very little interest among the judges. The real name of the virtue I'm discussing here is fluency. Are we enlightened when someone says, the gospel is, well, sort of almost, you know, true? Do we perceive some relation between the structure of the statement and the message? Are we brought closer to an understanding of the kingdom or our relation to the Savior by such a statement? Or do we simply heave a sigh of relief and say, at least we don't have to worry about his loyalty anymore? May I also say that those who think that the Holy Ghost is going to step in and supply the technical command necessary for the creation or perception of art are sadly mistaken. Over the years, the pieces I have seen, and not only in music, in which the authors claim to have received revelation from God, were generally inferior, which is to say that God was demeaned by their claim. Certainly, he is a better artist than any of us, and not an inferior one. I'm reminded of the brother who came to Brigham for the interpretation of a dream. He described a rather outlandish conglomeration of fantasies that made no sense whatsoever. Brigham asked him what he'd had for supper the night before. When the brother described a rather sumptuous meal topped off with half a raisin pie, Brigham suggested that he ought to go home and eat the other half of the pie and he would get his own interpretation. So I think we have to include fluency in our definition of what art is. The fluency is not just creator fluency, it is also listener fluency, performer fluency. The disdain that many feel for some of the great music of the past should not be seen as a deficiency of Bach, Beethoven, or Brahms, or others. They are, after all, not on trial. The deficiency is in the listener who does not understand them and their message, and it's nothing to be proud of. Ignorance may be bliss, but it certainly is not edifying. Much the same can be said for the response to a good share of our contemporary music, painting, or literature. People who decry the insights and efforts of our new artists are really revealing more about their own prejudices and limited background than the art they decry. So the first part of the definition of Mormon art is that it must be art, in the sense that it is technically competent and communicates the vision of the artist effectively. The other part is the Mormon part. If a work is good enough to be considered art, how does it become Mormon art? It is my view that we have Mormon art only when the vision that is communicated is a Mormon vision. The vision of the kingdom of God, of eternity, of man's relation to it all. In short, the vision of the restored gospel. In saying that, I do not wish to have you understand the term restored gospel in any superficial, sectarian, simplistic, or incomplete sense. Many of the most essential parts of that vision are those universals shared to some extent by all Christians, and some of them even by all religions in the world. These universals are legitimate and, thank God, unavoidable parts of the vision. In fact, I believe these universals are the home turf of the artist and make his message significant beyond the limits of church membership. As the artist or the church member deals with these universals, his emotional and intellectual understanding of the fundamentals of the gospel message are enriched and intensified. Works which deal with them are of proper interest to Mormons, and it is in this respect that many of the great works of the past are so deeply significant to members of the church. There are, however, many issues that are uniquely Mormon in their slant, in their implications, in their references. Works that embody these more provincial things are often not interesting to non-Mormons, but are of intense significance to those whose faith is identified with the church. While such works are clearly Mormon, I believe it rather Pharisaic to limit the term to the term Mormon art to them. These are works that frequently have little market value outside the church, and sadly, often little market within the church. Composers who turn out such works typically wrestle intensely with ideas and techniques that embody the ideas over long periods of time, only to see the works gather dust on the shelf. Often the intent to go to the core of an issue causes the artist to employ negative surface features that bring the issues into strong relief so that we may consider them intensely. Those who do not penetrate beneath the surface may be offended and try to eliminate the offensive surface. I'm thinking here of the fig leaf tendency to bowdlerize Shakespeare or the Old Testament. All too often, these attempts merely vitiate the vision and dilute the significance of the work. Most of them are simply ludicrous. Such attempts I abhor. Once in a while, a work comes to light and gets performed that embodies the vision in elegant ways that capture the imagination of our whole people. It is sometimes hard to determine whether such a work is seriously concerned with the vision or merely exploiting the markets. But on deeper penetration, we may see the technical command of the material becoming the servant of the vision, so that the structure of the work becomes unified with the structure of the vision, and we are all edified together. Such a depth of vision rarely occurs without the technical command that embodies it. Likewise, a true technical command is not possible without the vision. The two are part of each other and practically inseparable in the creation and perception of art. People who apologize that they know nothing about music or painting or literature have good reason to apologize, but little excuse for having neglected the acquisition of sufficient experience with the art to be able to relate to it. Sacrificing the opportunity of our young people to come into close contact with the excellence of the great masterpieces turns out to be a costlier sacrifice than we had dreamed, because it destroys precisely those things that build the perception central to LDS culture. If we lose those things, we lose the excellence that is so important to a continuing vitality in our culture. Because, you see, it is this experience and common understanding of excellence in vision and craft that it is in this experience that Mormon art finds its reason for being. There is a kind of communion with the Spirit of God in those high moments of artistic experience that enriches all we do and think and are. It is in the lack of such common experience that the problems of the Mormon artist come about. For one of our greatest problems is that too much of our Mormon audience has a view of Mormon and a view of art that makes such high communication improbable and renders impossible the establishment of the coincidence of intensity and craft, of the intensity of craft and vision which we ought to be seeking. After all, artists are not simply seeking to express themselves. Art is not merely some sort of harmless exercise used to fill up the spare time of the rich and indolent. The coinciding of craft and vision is always directed toward edification. As Bach said, his work was for the glory of God and the edification of man. The achieving of excellence in accomplishing that coincidence, both as creators and as audience, is a worthwhile activity, properly engaging not only the attention of the best minds of our culture, but also the broadest spectrum of our people and the use of our limited resources to accomplish it. I have not addressed the problem of style, nor will I, except to say that I consider style to be far less relevant than craft and vision. Leon Dallin used to say that a good pop song has a better chance for survival than a bad symphony. I also have to say that we see many works which do not attempt anything which is that has not already been done better by someone else. Such works encourage drowsiness in audiences and discourages us from engaging in the search for that lovely coincidence between craft and vision. So for me, Mormon art is, first of all, art, and has all the characteristics of art: the mastery of technique, concern for the performer, creation of new and interesting structures, the universality of message. And Mormon art must communicate the vision of the kingdom, the eternal plan, the beauty of the earth, the relations of man and God, and man to man, the restoration of the gospel, and the growth of the kingdom of God on earth. At one time, we were wrestling with one of the charter provisions from the Barlow Endowment, which states that works may be commissioned from non-LDS people if they are spiritual in nature. We asked Mr. Barlow what that meant. Could we commission only commission non-LDS people when the work had a scriptural text? Could only vocal works be scriptural or spiritual? His reply, and it was well considered, was very evocative. Quote, "I have always been taught that the gospel includes all truth. I guess it includes all beauty as well. May we seek to find the beauties of the gospel in all we encounter in our lives, even in those things that are negative on the outside. Inside, we often find a coincidence of art and vision that will lift us to higher planes." Thank you.
Our next panelist is Ann Cannon. She graduated with an MA in American Literature at Brigham Young, taught freshman English there for several years, and then went on to become a professional writer, first for local magazines like Utah Holiday and This People magazine, church publications, she says, both Orthodox and Un, and more recently has broken into the national young adult market, fiction market, with two books, both published by Dell, with the third, Amazing Gracie, I can hardly wait to read that one, coming out this fall, and a fourth, In the Hopper. One of her nonfiction claims to fame is being the daughter of BYU's head football coach, Lavelle Edwards. Ann?
I must say, of all the places, I didn't expect to hear that. It was here at Sunstone Symposium. Let me begin by saying that I'm extremely flattered to be here with this particular panel. And I will also confess that I feel just a little out of my element here because I do not regard myself as an artist, either Mormon or non. And I consider myself instead what Dr. Green just said, a professional writer. And I take a lot of pride in that. I feel like I'm an extremely hardworking professional writer, and that I'm a writer, and on my good days, that I'm better than most of those freshman students that I taught for 5 years at BYU. And that's where I am. I also feel like I don't have a broad knowledge of Mormon arts, except perhaps where Mormon literature is concerned, and even there, I'm not as well read as I wish that I were. Given those qualifications, I'm very happy to sit here and pontificate in sort of general terms for a while about my views on Mormon art, because this is something I have thought about a good deal over the years. And what's been interesting to me is how my feelings and my thoughts on the subject have changed. I'm going to tell you a little experience that I had when my first book was published. It's a book for what we call young adult readers. Basically, junior high age kids are the ones that are reading these books, 12 to 16. This book is called Cal Cameron by Day, Spider-Man by Night. And I've gone around and talked about this book, different book groups in the area. Well, I was in one particular book group one night where it was clearly understood that I'm LDS and that I'm an active LDS person. And one of the women there raised her hand and she said, "Well, I just have to tell you that your book didn't seem at all Mormon to me. If I had it to do over again, I would say to her, well, what do you mean by that? You know, what do you mean by Mormon? But instead, I immediately rallied to the book's defense, thinking that there was some sort of implied criticism there. And I said, well, of course it's a Mormon book. I said, just because I don't talk about bishops and wards and temple marriage, you know, and the celestial kingdom and all of those things, of course it's a Mormon book because I'm a Mormon. And my vision is Mormon, and my worldview is Mormon, and so the moral sense of the book, of course, that's grounded in my Mormonism. That's what I said that night. Okay. So my assumption then was that Mormon art didn't have to be particularly Mormon in its themes or its texture or anything like that. But I've had that experience since a number of times where somebody has said to me, you know what, your art just doesn't seem very Mormon to me. And I no longer take that as it depends on the context. Some people think that that's a criticism. Other people pay that as a compliment, you see. And I just say, oh, and I think that they're right. I think that my books probably aren't Mormon art. I don't even think they're Mormon books. And I will tell you what I think then Mormon art as regard, you know, particularly when we talk about literature really is. I think that to qualify as Mormon art, and I'm not even making the distinction that Dr. Bradshaw did here between good art and bad art, Mormon art to me has to be either one or a combination of these three things. It has to deal with overtly Mormon themes, either Mormon culture, Mormon history, or some aspect of theology that's uniquely Mormon. And I realize this is an extremely narrow definition, but I find that that's how I define Mormon art now, that it is recognizably Mormon. And I think that probably I do that simply because my interaction with so many people has led me to think that when people think of Mormon art, they often think in those terms, and I suppose at this point that I do too. And so the next question is this: can then a Mormon produce... a non-Mormon produce Mormon art? And I think absolutely. And I find out that President Kimball doesn't agree with me. Oh my, what can I say about that? It's a good thing I didn't read the speech before I came up with my chat here. But I think that I think there are examples of that happening. An interesting example to me is that I don't know how many of you are familiar with Network Magazine, but in last month's Network, there was quite an interesting article in there on the Angel Moroni that sits on top of the temple. And I think, you know, you've just got to consider the Angel Moroni as being sort of an archetypical piece of Mormon sculpture, okay? Obviously. It was sculpted by Cyrus Dallin, who was born into a Mormon family in Springville, but by the time he sculpted the Angel Moroni, he had long ago thrown over his Mormonism for Unitarianism. And so I guess there are some people that would argue, well, once a Mormon, always a Mormon, you know, that it's sort of an ethnic identity as much as a religious identity. But that, to me, is a case of a non-Mormon producing Mormon art. Can a Mormon produce non-Mormon art? Obviously, I think that's true, because I think that probably I do that. So the issue of, you know, who produces Mormon art and what it is, I think it's, you know, you don't, my feeling is that a Mormon is not the person necessarily that needs to produce Mormon art. And this, like I say, is a very exclusive definition, and it's antithetical to the definition of what Mormon art, where literature is concerned, of an organization that I'm involved with and that I would encourage you all to join, which is the Association for Mormon Letters. They regularly promote and talk about and review and discuss literature that is not just overtly Mormon, but literature that's produced by anybody who has any tangential connection with the LDS Church, which, you know, it's wonderful because we become much more aware of a lot of different things that are being done that way. Just doesn't happen to coincide with what my definition of Mormon art is, probably. I've been asked why I don't write overtly Mormon books. And my response is this. Right now, in my, you know, at the stage of my career that I'm in, I'm writing for a national audience. And I guess at some level, maybe I'm just too lazy to figure out how I can talk about bishops and wards and all of those sorts of cultural things without it taking up more time and energy than I want to spend on it. Okay, do you see what I'm talking about? How do you talk about those kinds of things and make it accessible when really that's not the thing that I'm interested in talking about anyway in my book? So I find that that is perhaps the reason I just sort of sidestep at least our cultural issues here when I talk about, you know, when I write. But I think even more than that, there's something about myself as well, but I find finally that the culture, Mormon culture, and I probably ought to define what I mean by that. I'm just talking about our social system, okay, the way that we live, the way that we relate to each other. It does not fire my particular creative imagination. And that's not a defect in the culture. I would say that's probably, you know, maybe a defect in my imagination. But it doesn't seize me enough to want to write about it in the way that it does some of our other fine Mormon writers. A lot of Mormon writers, whether they're active in the church or not, are intrigued by our culture and want to write about it. You see this in the works of a lot of people, Neil Chandler, Levi Peterson, Fillerout. There are any number of fiction writers in particular who are dealing with the Mormon culture. Having said that, I want to make this observation, which is that I sometimes wonder how really interesting, I don't have a sense for this because I'm not in the circles that would let me know this. I ultimately don't know how interesting Mormon art is going to be in some ways to people outside of the culture. Perhaps it'd be really interesting, and I think sometimes it is, but I think perhaps it's less interesting than we wish that it were. One night I was in a discussion group where people were talking about this sort of thing, and there was the Haim Podak thing going on, that's what I call it, which is that there are Mormon writers who sort of think that Mormons ought to be, you know, Mormon writers ought to be to Mormondom what Haim Podak is to Judaism, and they make the argument that, look, you know, he writes about a culture that's quite insular and that's difficult to understand, it's not readily accessible to the outsider, why shouldn't Mormons be doing that same sort of thing? And my response that evening was, well, for one thing, you know, we're talking about a really old, established culture as opposed to a much newer culture. You know, we're talking, the two cultures are not particularly analogous, even though there are a lot of, I think, LDS people who feel a strong kinship to the Jewish experience. I don't know that the kinship would be returned, the feeling. I don't know. So I think that there is a little bit of that problem, that we think perhaps what we have in terms of our cultural experience is a lot more interesting to the outside world than maybe it is. And it would be interesting to hear your responses about that, because I don't know. That's my impression of it. I think that there is a feeling, too, we have a very exalted notion of who we are and of what our role in the world is. I mean, my golly, we're not here only to save living people, but dead people too. I mean, you know, our mission is to save everybody, and we're the chosen ones to do it, and our church is the one and only true church. I mean, that's the orthodox, mainstream, standard American, standard Mormon response. So I think there's maybe a little bit more of a tendency to maybe we think we're a lot more interesting than we really are. Anyway, I don't mean to belabor this point. But that is and just to put this in some sort of context, I just want to throw this out to you. Okay, I'm assuming most of you here are interested in Mormon art, or at least the question of Mormon art, because in some way perhaps you're connected to the Mormon Church. Okay, would you be as interested in the topic of Seventh-day Adventist art? Okay, or Quaker art, or whatever other kind of art. Finally, Mormon art that's going to speak to people other than Mormons has got to be art that, yes, it can use Mormon themes, it can use Mormon details, but it's got to strike some sort of a universal chord. And this is the thing that you express so beautifully, but for it to move outside of our circle, it's got to hit on those things. I'm thinking that a story, and you see these kinds of stories in popular Mormon fiction where the heroine has to decide whether or not she's going to marry X out of the temple or Y in the temple. And, you know, that's a heartfelt struggle in Mormon circles, I know. But that's a story that's probably not going to speak outside of Mormon circles. Whereas I think you could take a story about a mother who has lost a missionary son on a mission and write compellingly enough about her grief and her anger that it could be interesting to a non-Mormon audience with the Mormon details. Those are the things that I think you would see happening in Mormon fiction that would make it more interesting. As to who's going to write that fiction or who is writing that fiction, I certainly think a good LDS person can do that, but I think it's going to have to be, and it is often, a writer who's not overly concerned about always putting the very best spin on Mormons or things Mormon or the institution or anything else. That writer can't have a vested interest in making us look great all the time. because once that happens, it just no longer rings very true. So basically, those are my observations about the state of Mormon art, and I'd like to hear responses afterwards. Thank you.
Our third panelist is Dr. Jay Fox. He received his PhD from Purdue University with an emphasis in 19th and 20th century British literature. He is former vice president for academics at BYU Hawaii, has directed the London Study Abroad program in both 1983 and 88, and is currently curriculum coordinator for the English department and director of the BYU Center for the Study of Christian Values and Literature and editor of its very fine journal, Literature and Belief. Dr. Fox.
Well, as I meditated on what I was going to do in the 15 minutes I had on this panel for a Sunstone audience, whatever a Sunstone audience is, I decided I might get a little bit of detachment by playing the role of observer, commentator, consultant, if you will, in this brief presentation on Mormon art, particularly Mormon literature. Why choose the role of a consultant? Well, because consultants who earn their pay usually help their clients diagnose situations. And since none of us are receiving absolutely anything for this, it's about what the consulting job will be worth. Consultants usually make their problems simpler than they really are, and because of time constraints, they have to generalize recklessly. The other advantage of playing consultant is that I can make observations, recommendations, without the trouble of believing anything that I say. Recently, I attended a meeting arranged by Clinton Larson between several prominent creative writers in the church and the people responsible for church publications. Elder Pinniger was there from the 70, who was responsible for that, Jay Todd from Church Magazines, Dean Hughes, Eugene England, a number of people. There are, I think, approximately 25 to 30. One of the questions that took considerable amount of time was why the church publications don't publish more of the type of writing that these writers are producing. I thought it was a good interchange. I heard writers asking for more official recognition of their art, and I heard editors and others describing the conditions that structure the selection of material needed to meet the translation and multicultural needs of a worldwide church. I left the meeting asking myself why most writers would even worry about publishing in outlets that seem to have so many restraints, as legitimate as those restraints are. But the fact is, they do. Now, what qualifies me as a consultant to address this kind of an issue? Well, actually, I'm not an expert on Mormon literature, even though I was on the executive board of the Association of Mormon Letters for 3 years, three long years. But I have been teaching and writing about literature for 26 years as a professor of English. Some of my former students, Mike Fillera, Bernice Perry, Stephen Goldsberry, have all done well in Mormon letters. For the last 8 years, I've read thousands of Christian poems, stories, personal essays, critical essays, and reviews for Literature and Belief in my role with the Center for the Study of Christian Values and Literature. And all of these written by Mormons and non-Mormons. So out of that experience, I feel I have some sense of what kinds of standards of judgment are used by various Christian audiences. For the purpose of this discussion, I'm defining Mormon literature as art that treats Mormon people, places, and or ideas, and it is written primarily by Mormons. Now, of course, it could be a lot more than that, but that'll sort of narrow it down. One of my first questions, like Anne's, is why we want to link religion and art in a cause and effect relationship anyway. Why do we often think that religion helps produce art? Hasn't literary history shown that the individual artistic talent emerges apart from its milieu? Wouldn't Michelangelo have succeeded in pagan Greece as well as in Christian Italy? Do we ask, as Anne suggested, about and expect the Great Jehovah Witness or Unitarian novel? For whatever reasons we're concerned about the relationship between literature and religion, I suspect as Mormons we want to succeed in this endeavor for at least two reasons. I think there's a whole body that wants to succeed because they want to promote a literature that can be self-critical of its culture. We want to look at the conflicts, contradictions, hypocrisy, self-righteousness, and etc. of Mormonism. I suspect another group also feel that true religion that has a conduit to revelation should use that revelation to produce quality art. It's the second point I wish to address directly. We're fond of quoting President Kimball's The Gospel Vision of the Arts that he gave as a talk back in the 70s, in which he said, "In our world, there have arisen brilliant stars in drama, music, literature, sculpture, painting, science, and all the graces. For long years, I have had a vision of members of the church greatly increasing their already strong positions of excellence till the eyes of all the world will be upon us." And then he quotes John Taylor as saying, "God expects Zion to become the praise and glory of the whole earth, so that kings, hearing of her fame, will come and gaze upon her glory." That gives us a fairly limited audience. I see we still have the King of Tonga, and we still have the King of, you know, I don't know how many of those are left. Members of the church should be peers or superiors to any others in natural ability, extended training, plus the Holy Spirit, which would bring them light and truth. With hundreds of men of God and their associates so blessed, we have the base for an increasingly efficient and worthy core of talent. He wasn't given, nor are we given, to worrying about sexist language in these things. In fact, somebody told me the New Mormon Encyclopedia doesn't concern itself with sexist language. I don't know how that's possible, but... What then is my assessment of what it would take to achieve this ideal? Well, let's just for fun briefly create an LDS standard of judgment in contrast to a modern or postmodern contemporary standard. First of all, on the role of the author. Much contemporary criticism wants to go beyond the new criticism of the 1920s and 30s, who made the intentions of the author fallaciously irrelevant. They want the author erased entirely from the text. Furthermore, the persona is not the person. And in much contemporary thinking, the person's private life is irrelevant. Yet in an LDS standard of intentions or motives, the author is fundamentally important. Furthermore, the person is important along with the persona. Mormons are close to the Victorians in this respect. Carlyle, the Victorian writer, said he could not tolerate those who tried to make him read and enjoy the atheist Shelley's work, or that of the sexually promiscuous Byron. To do so, he said, would be like telling someone that you were feeding them filet mignon when you were really giving them, quote, dead dog. Critics like Carlyle want artists with exemplary lives. Again from President Kimball, who acknowledges that great art can come from those whose lives are morally untidy, but he wishes for greater art from more worthy candidates. He says, "It has been said that many of the great artists were perverts or moral degenerates. In spite of their immorality, they became great and celebrated artists. What could be the result if discovery were made of equal talent in men who were clean and free from the vices and thus entitled to revelations?" And note the emphasis, my emphasis, cleanse him, and then take a look at the statues he will carve and the murals he will paint and the masterpieces he will produce. He is asking for art from what he considers to be inspired, active, faithful, worthy Latter-day Saints. Now, how about stylistic accessibility? In a century that gave us James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, any level of inaccessibility is permitted. Latter-day Saints standards of judgment for a Mormon audience require accessibility. Note the lack of non-representational art in church museums, publications, and etc. Just a little aside here, I had a Pre-Raphaelite Lady of Shalott hanging in my office, which I took down and put up a Lemoyne Garside non-representational art. He was trying to paint the space between chairs at a chateau in, you know, and it's non-representational. You can't believe the number of people who don't like the non-representational one. Okay, note the lack of non-representational art in church museums, publications, and etc. Ezra Pound's dictum, render, don't tell, won't work in this construct, this standard of judgment I'm proposing, if the rendering isn't accessible. If it is not, then instead of rendering, we begin telling, even to the point of, now, dear reader, so the point becomes clear. Harry Anderson realism becomes a kind of standard. How about historical accuracy? Imaginative literature has long ignored correspondence to accepted historical constructs. Who cares if Shakespeare set one of his plays on the non-existent coast of Bohemia? Well, what would it be like if we tried symbolically painting or writing about the first vision in the Mojave Desert? That could be symbolically very important, you know, the spiritual wasteland and so forth. But no, the standard of judgment calls for correspondence to a perceived and approved historical actuality. And actuality is in quotation marks. One of my professors' best definitions I've heard of history is an account of what might have happened. Or Wallace Stegner's definition, a fable agreed upon. Or I would say a fable disagreed upon. Okay, this type of art requires research. Wallace Stegner, again, is helpful. He says, quote, I should guess that the trick is to make the twin cutting tools of sound research and a sense of the dramatic work together like scissor blades. Okay, how about freedom of subject matter? The norm from the 1890s on has been, as Arthur Simmons put it, whatever has existed has achieved the right of artistic existence. And then a year later, he says, quote, we need absolute freedom of choice. This is, of course, not possible in this construct, the standard of judgment that I'm creating for Mormons. Most Mormon audiences cannot tolerate even an isolated, objectionable scene in context. I think the advantage, though, that the church and Mormon writers have is that they have never been too concerned about traditional canon. And as the traditional canon breaks up with multi-ethnic and multi-gender issues, I think Latter-day Saints will fit just fine within that. Okay, furthermore, content for this Mormon standard of judgment ought to be affirmative, at least what John Gardner calls affirmative. He says in Moral Fiction, good art is good, is, quote, good only when it has clear positive moral effect, presenting valid models for imitation, eternal verities worth keeping in mind, and a benevolent vision of the possible which can inspire and incite human beings toward virtue, toward life affirmation, as opposed to destruction or indifference. Such art is not cheap, cornball, or didactic, nor is it trivial. The challenge often is to present a believable, engrossing, non-sentimental depiction of the good. A challenge most difficult because the good, as Victor Hugo told us many years ago in his preface to Cromwell, has but one face. The grotesque has a thousand, he said. Thus, the fascination with Milton Satan against his cardboard God the Father. How about critical stance? The Mormon standard of judgment requires a critical stance to encourage the writing and evaluation of literature that goes counter to the current trends of contemporary critics who see no correspondence between arbitrary, indeterminate language and any transcendent, logocentric reality. The Mormon standard of judgment requires that we cannot, as Christians, remain neutral on this. And I think some of our best spokesmen for this are non-Mormons who are Christian. Bruce Edward, the vice president of the Conference on Christianity and Literature, says, quote, if one believes, as we do, that the most important consideration in the adoption of any critical theory or tool is how it may further or impede the establishment of the kingdom of God, how it may affect our understanding of the gospel, and how it may ultimately determine the way we treat other creatures whom we are called to love and serve, certain matters follow. Neutrality and critical method for the Christian is impossible. For the neutrality is not necessarily bias, but conviction. Soul-deep persuasion founded upon a corpus of fact. Greater and higher laws guide Christian academics than the editorial policies of avant-garde critical journals. God speaks or scripts, either we can hear and heed or we cannot. What does critical theory have to say about this preeminent and paradigmatic issue? Inseparable from the discussion of this or that critical method is what that method implies about our ability to discern and obey the meaning of God's text. Now that's by a non-Mormon. Well, the standard of judgment I've been describing will not appeal to many Mormon artists, nor should it. But what might it produce, or has it produced, to those who do or have tried it? Could it lead to art that was sanctioned by the church, admired by a large community of saints, and still have the praise of the world? It'll take more than a consultant to answer that question. Thank you.
Our last panelist is Gary Smith, former professor of art at Brigham Young University, now lives in Alpine and paints full-time. His works reveal a deep understanding of religious subjects connected to the restored church. He has painted one of the most moving depictions of the martyrdom of Joseph Smith I've ever seen. His style partakes of the hieratic attitude and graphic power of much ancient religious art. Some of his paintings look quite Byzantine in style, and is imbued with a symbolic subtlety that points toward the universal. His works hang in private, corporate, and museum collections throughout the U.S. and the world. Presently, he has a one-man show touring museums through the U.S. for the next 2 years. Gary?
I'll elect to stand. I've been confronted with the problem of being an artist in the church since I was 25 years old when I joined the church. And it happened at a time when I came into the church that there seemed to be an interesting core of things happening at that time, and that was a group of individuals coming together with similar ideas, which were crystallized by one person and given a philosophy. This movement, which happened around 1968 to 1974-75, grew into what became the Festival of Mormon Arts at BYU, under the leadership of Loren Wheelwright primarily, which was redefined in his own image. There's some things I think that I have learned over 25 years that to me has meaning, and being able to put my own values into, which has taken on more of a universal nature. And the dilemma that artists face in the church, and it seems to be universal and probably will always be there, is that artists and conformity are contradictory. When you stop and think about that, it's true, because it's not that artists don't conform. Artists do conform. It's that the whole concept of art is to create, and to create a new vision, or to create something new. And conformity to ideas or to principles is fine, it's good, it's something that we have to do. But I have seen over the years many artists that because of the concept of conformity and what they perceive their conformity to be, in some cases leave the church, or in some cases become less active, or reinterpret what their conformity to the church will be. And this has happened with almost every artist I know. And that's why I say being an artist is conforming is contradictory. Now, we all find our own way of doing that, and if you're going to become active, remain active in the church, everyone has to find their own way of doing this. It was a point in my life when I was confronted with this very thing, happening at a time when we were trying our very best to give our talents. There were a group of about five in an organization called the Art and Belief Movement. This has become really important to me in the last few weeks because there's being a paper presented tomorrow on that group. And it was a chance for me to go back and to reevaluate what had happened during that period. And there were some great things came out of that period. Some absolutely wonderful experiences came out of that. And I think perhaps will have some lasting effect, having looked back on it 20 years ago. I think there's some lasting effects that have happened. Dr. Bradshaw was mentioning that there is no unified effort out there today. There really isn't. It's become very individual. The church has like to call is the church's intent and the artist's intent. And there are two different aspects here. And I'm talking about the visual arts primarily. The church's intent with the visual arts is to teach. And I think that is number one goal. The fact that so-and-so painted this painting is incidental. It really doesn't have a whole lot of meaning to the overall social structure of the church as to who did what, as long as it has a nice message to it. And because of that, art in the visual sense has become primarily illustrative. And if you are to try to go beyond that and to deal with philosophy, it becomes abstract. And there's some nice things said about abstraction here today. It becomes abstract. And abstraction is a very misunderstood thing in the visual arts. Much of the abstraction we look at today that artists tend to conform to, I call it probably mostly influenced by our American culture and what's happening in the art world today. It's very seldom someone really reaches inside of themselves and finds something really important and significant. It's probably the most difficult thing an artist will ever be able to do. We all try to do it. And we all have our various ways of approaching that, but it's an extremely difficult thing to do because we are so influenced by so many things around us and so many things we've heard, read, and seen that it's very difficult to become what you would call maybe I can't think of the word right off now. Well, it'll come to me in a minute. But if we're going to really be artists that give a unique vision of the world, we've got to reach inside ourselves. And the church's intent, believe me, I know, because I've worked with the church for many, many years in trying to determine what their intent is that they're interested in a proselyting tool. And a proselyting tool is fine. And I think an artist has to determine, the visual artists have to determine if that is the mode they wish to do to become accepted. If you intend not to do that and you want to reach within yourself to find that meaningful thing, you just have to accept the fact that you're going to be misunderstood. And that's the thing that I think I realized mostly out of the art group that we had established at one time back in the late 60s, was that there is no precedent for Mormon art. There is no precedent out there. So what that means is every artist, music, one has to almost create a new art form to be what we would hope to be called a Mormon art. And I think that may be somewhat an impossibility without being able to look back or having at least the vision of a 50 to 100 years to look back. I think we're too close today to be able to see it. I don't think that we will be able to tell it even now if we were to see it. But I think perspective gives us will give us a lot of definition as to what this culture really does produce. And if it's meaningful, they say that the great art reaches the greatest mass of people over the greatest amount of time, over the longest amount of time. And we really don't have that perspective as yet. We have great craftsmen in the church. I know within the visual art world today, there are probably as many great artists out that reside in Utah that make their living out of the state of Utah as there is anywhere in the United States. And there's a lot of artists that are getting great national recognition because of their art. Locally, people hardly even know who they are. And I think that's just a fact of life. It's something that we don't necessarily look for encouragement from anyway. But it's a lonely road. It's a lonely road, and it's something that everyone has to determine for themselves as to who we are, how we're going to project the values and the ideals that we have. Sister Cannon was making a comment about universal values, and I believe in universal values. I think that if we're going to reach people on a broad mass level, they have got to be done through universal values, values that everyone can understand. And that certainly is not contradictory to LDS thinking. Universal values are really, to me, what the church is all about, is to be able to teach your kids the proper things to do in life and have the best life you can with the knowledge and experiences that you obtain through this life. Now, Mormonism gives us a little bit of a unique vision on that. And I think that every artist finds their own way of interpreting that vision. And I think that that to be able to really project that vision, it has to be unencumbered. It cannot be done through commission. It cannot necessarily. It perhaps might be. But the artist's vision is important. And if we are to ever attain this world renown that I think that we hope for in the arts, it's got to be a very, very personal and a very lonely road, and it has to deal with universal values. Now, it's okay to sprinkle in a few things based upon Mormon society, philosophy, or theology. That's fine. Most people won't understand. Reading something about Orson Scott Card not too long ago, who's writing science fiction, introducing a lot of Mormon values into his science fiction, and nobody even knows what he's talking about. But yet, there are those clues, and someone that's LDS is going to pick right up on that and say, yes, that's what we're talking about. But our hope, I think, is to be able to inspire as many people as we can by what we do. And that's only going to come by paying our dues out there, perfecting our craft to where no one is going to criticize us for that, and giving forth imagery and words and music and that's going to inspire people. And to me, that's what Mormon art should be, is a positive viewpoint of life. A positive viewpoint. There's certainly the negative side of that too, but the negative can even be interpreted as positive. And so that's, to me, what my goals are, at least, and they're difficult goals to achieve. And I very seldom ever even think about Mormon art anymore, or even what Mormon art is. I think of trying to project my own values and my own goals through the best way that I can. So I hope that would probably all be our goals. Now, I'm not saying that the church's intent is not the right intent for artists, because there are artists out there whose only goal is to serve those purposes, and I think that's great. I think that every artist has to define for themselves what they want out of this. But there is definitely, at this point in time, two intents. There is the artist's intent, and there is the church's intent. And the artist's intent is generally of a more personal nature. The church's intent is generally of a more universal nature among its people. So, 25 years of perspective on this kind of brought me to this point, at least. And I'm still projecting many of the ideas that I did 25 years ago through my own work. They're just a little more subtle. And they're taking on a different perspective. But I have people from time to time say them, will look at them and feel something there that they saw, not understanding it totally and sensing that there was something there that was maybe just a little bigger than what I intended or what they intended when they first saw it themselves. So artists are by nature unconforming, and I think it's a good thing that we are. It's an important thing that we are. And if we were to become more conforming, I think we would lose our artistic soul. So thank you very much.
Nevertheless, they are very conforming in terms of the time. I appreciate that. Okay, this has been very eye-opening for me, and I hope for you also. I have a lot of questions. I think I will just basically reflect on a couple of things that I have been struck by here and then turn the time over to you for your reactions to their comments. Appreciated Dr. Bradshaw's linking craft and vision. I think that was a very important part of his presentation. And these universals that he talks about are the home turf of all Mormon art. In fact, universality seems to be kind of a prevailing theme of the papers today. I was struck by Dr. Fox's listing of things that, I mean, I had never imagined how many of those are so restrictive. And if we followed that critical standard, which is the implied critical standard of most people when they talk about Mormon art, it would produce probably nothing of any substance, which leads us to, I suppose, to reconsider our critical methods, at least our attitudes. I really enjoyed Anne's rather iconoclastic position here, sort of taking the devil's advocate point and very articulate, has made me reconsider what I had for many years had as a kind of basic definition of Mormon art. And then Gary's has raised some very, I think, troubling questions about how to reconcile artistic freedom with institutional conformity, if that is even an ideal to strive for, institutional versus personal intent, or religious persuasions versus artistic integrity. If a person, as I assume some of his friends have felt that conflict and have opted for art over the church, in other words, one would assume if they leave the church because they can't reconcile their art to the church that they have chosen their art over the church, what that says about the occupational hazards of being a Mormon artist. Anyway, I will turn the time over to you and let you address your questions to any of the panelists, and we would encourage as possible to participate.
Sure.
Or maybe the question should come from the panelists to you.
I have a question.
Can I make one really quick reaction to that? I used to sing in a choir that and we would say, Layla, why can't we sing a little more Bach and Beethoven, a little less I Walk Today Where Jesus Walked? And she says, well, we have an audience to contend with here, and we need to touch them where they are, not where we want them to be. And so she mixed them together, hoping that the higher art perhaps would infect them as they began to be moved by the more common, not common, the more accessible songs that we sing in ward choirs.
You can't raise people up by coming down to
their level.
Reaction. That's where I have to tell a story about my mother-in-law. She was a singer. And she was in a situation where she constantly was called upon to deal with ward choirs, usually to direct them, but in this one case she was called upon to sing in a Christmas program with the ward choir, and it wasn't a very good ward choir to start with. And at the end of the meeting, my wife went up to her mother and said, Mother, I could hear you over the whole group. And she said, I refuse to blend. Now, it seems to me that there are some things that we learn from this. One is that ward choirs are always with us. And I say that in a bit of a pejorative sense, that we have those functional things in the church which are providing a liturgical or a social that will always be with us. And it will always be done on many different levels. I was in a ward in Manhattan a year and a half ago, well, just a little over a year ago, where the special number in sacrament meeting was the first movement of the Beethoven Pathetique Sonata, played by a 13-year-old girl and played exceedingly well. And it reaches from there downward, and as you've indicated, we don't know where the bottom is. But I think we keep trying, and I think we keep understanding that there are needs on many levels, and those needs will be met one way or another, and we have to live with those. I think I'll stop with that. I'd rather hear more questions and more of my own voice.
I think it's important to remember that Sherry's question is from somebody who has an education in English. And I think that our standards of judgment come from education. And I'm not saying that education is what everybody needs in order to have that standard of judgment. But it's an acquired taste. And the Spirit can operate without the acquired taste. I mean, I can take a poem in my English classes at BYU by an unknown woman named Eliza Cook. It's called The Old Armchair, okay? And from my point of view, having come up through an acquired taste, it's drivel. I mean, she goes on and on about how her tears flow down like lava tide as she thinks about this armchair, you know, and that she remembers her mother in this armchair. Then I put it alongside of a poem by D.H. Lawrence that is very controlled and subtle, that talks about he is remembering sitting under the piano and listening to his mother's play the piano, and even though he didn't want to cry, he wanted to be a man, he couldn't help it. That music just took him back, and he says, "My manhood is betrayed and I break down." Which poem do they prefer? This is in a beginning course. They prefer the old armchair. And they find it moving, and they associate it with their mother. You know, and they can feel the Spirit with it, if you will. It is an acquired taste. And I think the way that literary criticism is moving today, it's going to go more to looking at the piece of art as an artifact in a social, political, cultural context, and not this what we call high art, bellette, whatever you want to put on it, that my generation acquired by studying the traditional canon at a university. And I think you have to keep those perspectives in mind. And I'm not quite so hard on a day, a night, and a day as Sherry is. I call it bathrobe drama.
Freudian slip.
Yeah, probably better. You know, it is bathrobe. You know, you get a group of people together and put bathrobes on, and they play ancient people, you know, like we did in the Christmas pageant, you know, and so forth.
A rather disturbing thing I see happening over and over in sacrament meetings, at least down our ward, is these young teen pop pseudo-Mormon compositions that tend to be perpetuated, and I don't know if you have them where you live, but really what we are is a product of our American society, and our American society tends to go to the lowest common denominator for entertainment to many degrees, and I believe pretty much what the others have said, and that is that it is a form of education that has to take place. But people can feel things too, and perhaps that's the greatest job of an artist, is to allow one to feel something you're trying to do. And no matter how sophisticated it may become, hopefully it would transcend to the sophisticated as well as to the less so.
I have one more thing to say, and that is, the excuse for doing that kind of thing in sacrament meetings is that we have an audience. Well, dadnabbit, I'm part of that audience too. And if I were as intolerant of that stuff as they are of my stuff, I would get up and leave every sacrament meeting that I go to. And I'm on the high council in a student stake, and they're freshmen. And we get what they bring with them, and it's not really very good. And all I'm asking is that if we are insisting that the artist be tolerant of the others in the audience darn well ought to be tolerant of the artists. I know so many people who would like to wear earplugs in sacrament meeting because the music is so bad.
Actually, I do have something to say. Oh, good. You go ahead and ask your question. Maybe I don't. Actually, I was thinking of something, which is that I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that enjoyment of sort of lower art forms doesn't preclude enjoyment of higher art forms in the same person. I work at a bookstore, and one of the things that I do is I go out to junior high schools and do book fairs very often. This is one of my very favorite stories. I had a 13 or 14-year-old girl come in, just, you know, how they are when they're that age. Their snottiness hormones are raging. I mean, they're just awful. Anyway, she came in, and she said, "Do you have any more Trixie Belden books?" And I said, "No, sorry, we're just fresh out of Trixie Belden today." And she's, rant. And so she's walking out with her girlfriend. I don't know. And all of a sudden she sees Jane Eyre on the table. She picks it up and she goes, "This is the best book I have ever read in my life." And her girlfriend buys it. Well, I thought this was so interesting because I think this is how so many of us respond to the arts, which is that she can enjoy Trixie Belden, but she can also enjoy Jane Eyre. And, you know, we can enjoy, we all have guilty pleasures when it comes to television viewing, but we may also enjoy something that's higher up on the totem pole. And I think it may, you know, we need to keep that in mind and maybe think about ways of dispensing, you know, higher quality art and get it out there, because I think people will respond to it, maybe more than we give them credit for. So.
Good. Yes.
I think part of the problem is some of us innately aren't, you know, very artistic. Brother Bradshaw knows that, you know, I'm maybe close to competent as a musician, but not brilliant. And Brother Fox knows I'm close to competent as a writer, but not brilliant. And I feel like the common denominator doesn't really have so much to do with art as it does with the gospel. It seems to me that it may be our understanding of the gospel that's skewed, that's preventing us from appreciating higher things in art. That maybe what we assume is the Spirit of God is often just maudlin sentiment, and that we mistake the Spirit of God or something that's just a warm feeling, which you can get any number of ways by eating bad pizza. And that really the Spirit of God is much more an intellectual thing than most Mormons assume. And I get the feeling that our religion has been diluted, and that perhaps if more of us would teach correct gospel principles about the nature of the Holy Spirit and the nature of inspiration and revelation, that we would naturally encourage arts, because I think that's the one thing we can all handle. I tell you, it's darn difficult to teach freshmen to appreciate things artistic, because I don't think they're old enough, frankly. And I think there's something that about aesthetics that goes with having experienced life. And so I think, though, that if we perhaps revise our perceptions of what constitutes truth and revelation and inspiration, the Holy Spirit and all that, why, we could have a much broader artistic base in the church. That's pretty abstract. But
no, it's not abstract at all. It's a very, very pointed point.
Holy Ghost is always abstract.
That's right. But the discernment that comes through the Holy Spirit really should keep us from being moved by things that are not worthy of our, you know. That's a good point. Yes?
I have a BFA in art from BYU, and for a long time I struggled with almost a cynical intolerance for anything that was not educate art. But the thing that turned me around is I just learned that you have to look at the intent, and you have to look at the person, and this might sound sappy, but it's almost a love for your fellow man, where you learn to appreciate their taste and to respect them, because it's Brother Bradshaw said, you know, they might look at you with the same critical eye.
when I teach my classes, I teach humanities classes, and we try to turn students on to the arts, to ballet, that's a hard one, and opera, and convert them, basically. I mean, it is a kind of a conversion course, but we try to teach them to have, as you're suggesting, a kind of a floating scale of criticism so that you can shift your expectations depending on what is possible within that context. You don't judge, for example, a roadshow performance on the same standards you would judge, say, the Metropolitan Opera. So in that way, I think we probably can learn from this, yes.
That's very true, but even in varying spheres, there's good and bad. And there are some things that even in the lower spheres are bad, and yet people like them. Mm-hmm. Just because they're family-oriented.
Okay. Yes, comment?
I think a lot of the problem is that we don't take enough time. Peck's book, The Road Less Traveled, he talks about walking up to the guy who's fixing the lawnmower, and he says to him, "Ooh, I wish I could do that." And the guy fixing the lawnmower says, "You could if you took enough time." Madeline L'Engle, that writes children's fiction, I had the privilege of interviewing her when she came to BYU, and she says, "The way I approach the music of my children is I promise them I will listen to it at least 9 times. That was the thing. I will listen to it at least 9 times before I make a judgment." And I can remember as an undergraduate not liking Shakespeare at all. You know, I couldn't understand it. I couldn't follow it. And now I love and teach it, but it was through exposure. It was mainly through seeing it on study abroad for a year, you know, and seeing it done well. And so I think a lot of it is taking the time.
The other thing I was going to talk about before I ran out of time, and I ran out of time last week, so I decided not to talk about it then, but the other thing I was going to talk about is what I call the infrastructure, which in the church really doesn't exist. We used to have some vestiges of an infrastructure. The infrastructure is that combination of creators and audience and critics and purveyors who understand the same kind of things and talk to each other and make things happen. Now, there are some places in the world where that happens. I think the Jewish community is one where that happens a good deal, and they're very protective of their creators and work hard to see that the things that they are creating are purveyed by their purveyors and so on. We don't have anything like that. And judging from what's happened in the last 20, well, actually I could go from the date since February 1st, 1976, we're not likely to have an infrastructure for a long time. And that means that our artists work in an enclave and have to work, as Gary suggested, surrounded as much as they can be by the ideas and feelings and things that they can gather together where they are, and then they have to do their own thing as an individual. And it doesn't matter if you're at BYU. I was at BYU when the Art and Belief group was going, and I got some vibes from them a little bit. But I wasn't part of that group. And I would like to have been, but I didn't have time for it because I had my own enclave going. And I worked in my own enclave. And I think that's going to happen until we get someone, and I don't know who it's going to be, who can create an infrastructure where we get critics and audiences and purveyors of literature and painting and music together with the creators and understand each other.
How are we ever going to have exposure in the art when there is so much control put on Mormon art? I came here because I didn't understand Mormon art. I'm an aspiring artist. I've been told I can't be Mormon and an artist. So I sympathize with Gary. I understand what he's saying. I think that you can be a Mormon and an artist, but I don't think as an artist you can do Mormon art under the control of the stipulations and the guidelines that are set down now. How will we ever have
exposure? This concept you're talking about, Mormon art, is really the thing everyone has to define for themselves. There is no Mormon art per se that you can point to and say this is an example. There are different things done by Mormon artists, And I'm saying a little perspective is going to give us, it's going to tell us more about what these things are, you know. I mean, we may not be around in 50 years, but we may be a little bit more, it may be a little more defined as to what that means. I think the only thing that you can do is basically what I've resorted to, and that is just kind of be yourself. I mean, you have values, you have certain things that that you believe, and try to just put them down. Try to put them down the very best way you can, and don't worry too much about whether you're fulfilling that great responsibility you've placed on yourself.
Yeah, I've always maintained that, who was it that said that, Brother Talmadge or Brother Witzel, that we'd have our Mormon Shakespeares and our Mormon Chaucers, and who said that?
Carson Whitney.
Oh, yeah, well, that was my third guess. But I've always thought that whoever that person was did all future and aspiring Mormon artists a great disservice, because in a way, if you've grown up with that held out in front of you, you almost feel obligated to try to be the great one, you know, at least at a certain stage in your life you do, and then you get past that, hopefully. And so I think your advice is very good, to just find your own voice, find your own vision, and then go from there. So
I have to argue with one more thing, and that is and maybe it's a little bit of taking issue with President Kimball, which I seldom do, because I admire the man so much. But I think we too often expect that in order for an artist to be an effective artist, he has to be a perfect man. And there's an intolerance involved in that viewpoint, which I think is terrifying. If you expect